Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today, as we're recording this right now, it's the evening of Thursday, January 14th, and I say that timestamp because who knows what's going to happen between when we record this and the time that it's released into the world. Typically, this podcast is interviews with interesting folks from around the world of pop culture. But this month, because of all the activity, all the events that have occurred, especially in the United States over the course of the last couple weeks, I want to use this podcast as a space to reflect on what's going on, to react to what's going on, to hear people like myself process things in real time. And so hopefully that is valuable to you. It's kind of what I hope to hear from the podcast that I listen to. And so trying to walk the walk here. Joining me to do that reacting and reflecting is my partner in life, at Joy of Napping. How are you doing today, Joy?
I am still here.
That is good to hear. That's good to hear. So, a lot has happened over the course of the last couple weeks. The news has continued to accelerate. The rate of events has continued to accelerate. Trump was impeached yesterday for the second time. He becomes the first president in history to hold that distinction. And I thought we would take this opportunity to kind of reflect on all the stuff that's happened over the course of the last week. Because when the assault on the Capitol happened on January 6th, and then we like recorded a reaction to that. There was a lot that we didn't really know about what was going on. I posted that reaction on my Patreon page, but now that a little bit more information has come to light, you know, our thoughts have crystallized a little bit more on this topic. So let's just start with where your head's at right now. What are you thinking about on sort of this historic week where Trump has been impeached a second time with just, you know, dozens of hours left in his administration?
It's more dozens than I would like, but yeah, it is the waning days. I have a few categories of thoughts, and you said our thoughts have started to crystallize, and I would say barely started on my part. I think there's a lot we still don't know.
Yeah, and actually, I think it's very notable how much we don't know yet, right? There's still, to this moment, been no like public briefing by a law enforcement agency or a press conference.
I think there was one, but it wasn't by like the people you would think. I think it was like a acting attorney general or U.S. attorney, you know, so it wasn't a senior, as you would normally think.
Right. And there's just like a lot of information we don't know. There's a lot of journalists putting together things based off of interviewing people and assembling video footage and things of that nature. But there's still so much we don't know. And so we're still in the middle of whatever is happening. We're in the middle of the event. We can't fully provide context until after we've lived through the entire thing. And we don't know when that will be. So just if you're listening to this in the ashes of civilization, you know, decades from now, we didn't have full access to the facts as of this moment. So it is notable how much we don't know right now. All that said, of what we do know, what are your thoughts?
Well, I guess, you know, there are three sort of lines of thinking I have. One is about stuff that happened up to, let me just call it the violent uprising. Both the January 6th one and ones that may still be to come. But sort of I have a violent insurrection sort of running train of thoughts. Then I have a like, what happens to Trump and Trumpism train of thoughts, which, I mean, not every Trump supporter is violent, clearly, you know, so there's still some really dangerous ideas that he not just fosters, but like is galvanizes, you know, like really it's not just a dog whistle, it's like a lightning rod kind of thing, you know, like he's able to just amass so much energy around. And of course, one but not the only one is white supremacy. And then like the third train of thought I have, which is definitely the best train of thought, the happiest place, is there's an incoming Biden administration, and you know, like I'm starting to feel that as a fact. And what that might look and feel like is quite surreal in comparison to the not just ineptitude, but also like just total absence of a real government right now. So yeah, those are like the things that are kind of rattling around in my head.
Shall we start with the first one then? Violent, sure. Violent uprising.
Let's go from least happy to happiest.
I think that, you know, we were horrified by the images and sort of descriptions of what came out the day of. And as time has gone on and more information has come to light, it seems more upsetting, right? Like sometimes you see like an event happens and you're like, oh, actually, it wasn't actually that bad, right? Like, or...
yeah, like hundreds feared missing dead and or feared dead. And then it turns out to be like five people died. And it's not like that's good, right, but right, like, right. That's not as bad as you thought.
Because extremely frequently, like when there's a large scale event like this, like the initial reports are wrong, right? And so you're hearing tons of like anecdotal data and lots of misinformation online. And then you, when the final dust, like the dust settles and the smoke clears, it's like, oh, that actually wasn't as bad as we thought it was. But in contrast, as we found out more about this event, it seems like it was actually way worse. And also, not only was it way worse, could have been even worse than what we thought, which was already quite bad, right? I think that you hear these stories of like, oh, these people were seconds from like breaching the chamber and like...
While people were still in there.
And like that there were people who, like if they had gotten in, their intention was to take people hostage or was to hang people or kill people. Or at least assault people. And it's like, it feels, again, we don't have full information, but it feels like we came really close to some of those terrible things happening. And it just seems like, you know, according to reports we've heard, like I saw Jake Tapper tweeting about this, like Republicans specifically don't seem to have any sense of how bad it could have gotten, is what I sense.
So before we get into like the party reactions to it, I think it actually was worse than we thought. Like, I've read that an officer was shot with their own gun. That person is expected to live. But, like, that's pretty terrible. And another thing that I think is a bit underreported is that there's, like, a narrative that after a couple hours, the National Guard finally showed up and was able to supplement the Capitol Hill or the Capitol Police enough that they were able to push the protesters out.
Mm-hmm.
Protesters, rioters, whatever you want to call them. And I think at that point, it was, like, kind of more quote-unquote peaceful than not. But really, like, a different way to say the same set of facts is that I think the rioters didn't do all the damage they could have with the weaponry they had with them. They, in fact, like, I think they ceded the building. And they didn't, like, fight to the death, which they could have if they wanted to. And I think that is what is so emboldening for future attacks, is that the reason that things weren't worse was partly because they chose not to push it even further.
Yeah.
So in my sense, it could have been worse, not just because, oh, it was like a lucky escape, but also like that was a little bit of a design choice to like really show everybody we could take this if we wanted to, and to be intimidating, which succeeded. Almost all of the fatalities were actually like accidental fatalities of like people who attended and like tased themselves by accident or whatever. And then there was one person who was beaten to death, a police officer. And then there was another police officer who killed himself as a but that also feels somewhat like sort of secondary. So basically, they didn't go on a murderous rampage. And I'm not saying like, oh, we should thank them for that. But more like, I don't think we should say, oh, we were so lucky.
Yeah, I think that's completely fair. And I mean, there are horrifying descriptions of what happened that day. One of them comes from the Washington Post, entitled 6 Hours of Paralysis Inside Trump's Failure to Act After a Mob Stormed the Capitol. This is, you know, I'm not a psychologist, but this is sounds like truly sociopathic behavior. I'll read just a couple paragraphs from the article here. Hiding from the rioters in a secret location away from the Capitol, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy appealed to Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor. Senator Lindsey Graham phoned Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter, and Kellyanne Conway, a longtime Trump confidant, called an aide who she knew was standing at the president's side. But as senators and House members trapped inside the U.S. Capitol on Wednesday begged for immediate help during the siege, they struggled to get through to the president, who, safely ensconced in the West Wing, was too busy watching Fire TV images of the crisis unfolding around them to act or even bother to hear their pleas, end quote. I mean, the picture that emerges from this article is people begging for their lives. Please do something. And
people who are his closest allies and supporters.
Yes, people who have supported him, they've carried his water, they've like deflected, you know, and he couldn't be bothered to just say, hey, stand down. He didn't want to be weak.
Actually, one of the worst details to come out of the day of reporting for me is that someone said, and it's an anonymous source in the White House, I think they told Maggie Haberman, I don't know who, whether it was the New York Times or the Washington Post, but the problem was that it was on live TV and that he really likes to watch live TV live. But if it's recorded TV, he'll pause it and then he can like engage with you and you can get his attention.
Yeah.
So the fact that it was live, like he couldn't be bothered, partly because like it would break his attention span. And he has like a very limited capacity to process things is partly, I mean, Rex Tillerson, the former Secretary of State and former CEO of ExxonMobil, gave a blistering interview to, I think, Foreign Policy magazine, in which he's like, yeah, like he can't focus on three things. He can't focus on two things. He can't really read. So then you have to have charts. You can give him maybe like a piece of paper with two bullet points on it. But like his capacity is so limited.
Yeah. Like they're saying like he can't really have a conversation like you and I are having right now where you can like have multiple ideas going on at once and like, you know, reflect back on them. He's like, they found like presenting a bulleted list to him was like very useful. And then like even more than like two to three bullets would be too much for him to handle. So it's really just like one or two bullets with like a sentence each and maybe some pictures. And like, that's the best way to communicate with them.
So, I mean, you've called the behavior sociopathic, and I think that's like certainly accurate to, I mean, not a psychologist, but it feels accurate. But then like what I'd layer on top of it is like, what if you were a sociopath, but also had like no cognitive firepower so that you like couldn't actually think about more than one thing at a time. Your pleasure center is being like stimulated by, oh, look at all those people who are there because of me.
Right.
And like the secondary thing is, but that might be bad for others, like never enters your brain.
Correct. Because you can't like balance those two ideas at once.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. So that's horrifying.
Yeah.
You know, to reflect on that, like,
that's the guy we put in office.
He's the guy who has the nuclear codes to this moment as we're recording this episode. So good stuff. Good stuff. You know, on that note, we should point out that Trump was banned by many social platforms like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Letterboxd, Snapchat, Twitch. And it's pretty, I gotta say, I mean, many of these platforms have benefited from extremism and Trump over the course of the last few years. They've monetized it. They've gotten, their stock prices have risen because of it. And so it's, I don't think of them as heroes or anything, but it is still shocking that these social platforms have taken more action against Trump than the U.S. government as of this moment, right?
Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I mean, the government is designed to move slowly, so like and with good reason, you know, that doesn't prevent them from abusing that power and like, quote unquote, accidentally killing people of color all the time and, you know, like a bunch of other terrible outcomes. But I wouldn't want the government necessarily to, you know, in this case, I wish there were better mechanisms available. But anyway, I think the point about speed is interesting because I think that there's sort of a narrow window between January 6th and the January 20th inauguration that's viewed as so dangerous that these tech companies were willing to move pretty fast, and it ended up looking coordinated, which I don't actually think it was, but has in fact left many on the alt-right scrambling to reorganize fast enough to get like the volumes of people who they could have gotten otherwise. And I think that is genuinely disruptive for a short period of time. And we're looking at a short period of time till the inauguration. It's not like I think the, you know, threat of violence dies down after that, but it does feel like it might somewhat get us through this window.
Yeah. I also agree with you. It's probably not coordinated, but when many tech companies take action at once, like, or roughly around the same time, it kind of like diffuses the energy that goes like the backlash because they've all done it. Do you know what I'm saying?
You think so it diffuses that? I mean, if anything, I feel like it amplified the talking point that, you know, it's effectively censorship.
Yeah, that's a future problem for these companies. You know, it's not necessarily a present day problem. I think that like, if it was just Facebook that did it, everyone would be talking about, hey, Facebook banned Trump. But if it's like Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Snapchat, Letterboxd, it's not about Facebook anymore. Do you know what I'm saying?
Did you say Letterboxd?
Yes.
Did Donald Trump have a Letterboxd account?
No, but I think they banned him anyway.
It's Home Alone 2. And that's it.
Yeah. So your first train of thought was around like the insurrection and that kind of thing. And I'm curious if you have any further thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, just to round out this idea that it was worse than we expected, I think it's worse actually than we knew. You know, there's like a strong claims being made. We haven't seen evidence yet, or not much evidence, that possibly one or more congressmen or their staff were in on it, which is above and beyond even the number of Capitol police who might have felt okay with it. I mean, the portrait that's emerging of the Capitol Police is very complicated.
Yeah.
But also, like, people who are currently in, you know, law enforcement or fire departments or former military or maybe even current military who, you know, are sworn to defend and protect us and the Constitution, who might have thought that this, I mean, I truly believe that everyone that was there thought they were doing the right thing, which is it's just a gulf. It's like really hard for me to imagine bridging. But I think that, you know, the extent to which it's an inside job, that's going to be really tough. Like, if you think about the impeachment vote, you're basically asking people to police their own behavior. And as we know, like, that basically largely doesn't work. So that's, you know, pretty upsetting. And I think that kind of thing is going to take a lot of time for us to get to the bottom of.
There's all these threads going on right now. There's an article at NBC News. As usual, I'll link to all the articles in the show notes. Some Democrats in Congress are worried their colleagues might kill them. That's the headline at NBC News. Quoting from the article here, after last week's deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol, supporters of President Donald Trump, by supporters of President Donald Trump, members of Congress are expressing something once unthinkable, that some of their own colleagues may be endangering their lives, not in a rhetorical sense, but in a direct and immediate way. It's the most poisonous I've ever seen, said Representative Don Beyer of Virginia. There's the overall sense that maybe if some of them have guns, and likely the ones who are more into conspiracy theories and QAnon with the pedophilic satanic rings, are we safe from them? End quote. There's these vivid imagery of people going to House members going to vote after a metal detector had been installed, and like some of them refused to go through the metal detector. And these are the same people who refuse to wear masks as well in the chamber, or like will protest the mask. And it's just like,
yeah. And now four members of Congress, all Democrat, by the way, like, I don't think any Democratic members of Congress had gotten COVID up until now, which I think is right. But four have since January 6th. And, you know, I believe all four, at least three, were in that room where a bunch of them were sheltered together, and the Republicans refused to wear masks, or many of the Republicans.
Yeah. Like Pramila Jayapal, who's like our representative, and that's infuriating because she's awesome, and
she's a person, you know, and she just deserves to not get COVID because of somebody else's. Like, I don't care that she's a congressman and she's awesome. I do. I like her quite a bit, but like, just because she's a human being, yeah. Like, just the callousness.
I saw people. Someone said online, this is great observation, but like, there's something really bizarre about people who will refuse to submit to metal detectors, but are okay with not wearing masks. They basically just want to kill someone, you know, like they have a gun on them, and so they might use it, but they don't care about preserving other people's lives. They don't care about saving other people, because if they did, they'd have the mask. So a lot of people have said like the GOP is a death cult, and it's putting it very strongly, but every single thing I've seen over the course of the last couple of weeks has reinforced that viewpoint.
Let me just say the less heated version of that, sure, which is that there is an emphasis on individual choices and liberty, and that impingement on that is a slippery slope toward government regulation of your actions and ultimately even thoughts, right? Like that is the
charitable diplomatic way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a long running thing that people have talked about in American history.
Yes. And what we're seeing is people taking it to the logical extreme, right?
Right. So like the Bill of Rights is in tension with itself, right? Like every single right that we have has to take place in some sort of understanding that there are trade-offs. So the famous freedom of speech ruling is like, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater,
yeah,
and endanger people's lives. And, you know, like, but that other than that, speech is like very, very, very protected. And Twitter basically made the decision that, you know, they are not free speech. Like, there are many ways to express yourself that are not Twitter, but Twitter basically kind of came out in a similar place, right, in their decision, which is like, you have directly incited violence, and like the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness of other people is another sacred right, and it feels like that one's gonna outweigh the right to speech that we have in the form that we've created.
Yeah.
And so I just feel like the degree to which the individual liberty is taken to extraordinary extremes that sort of imply we don't live in a society are very cultish, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, if you want to say it's a death cult, I think that's actually not totally wrong. but I think you can place it on a like spectrum of that it started at a place you could understand, at least.
I mean, that's very well put, very articulate, a much better way of putting it, which is that, yeah, that basically these rights taken to the extreme can generate cult-like behaviors. Obviously, the cult of personality around Donald Trump and him disregarding this disease as any kind of, the coronavirus as any kind of danger, telling you should just live your life and not let this thing dominate you, also plays into that. But in any case, the assault on the Capitol, very upsetting, and it's been fascinating to see the result play out between Trump being banned from social platforms, which are like reporting that they're organizing for a second round of attacks. So like the next week or two, I think we're going to see more attacks. I don't have any information. It's just what I've read in the news. That,
yeah,
like,
but dates I've heard are like the 16th, 17th, 19th, 20th. Right. I'm like, oh, okay. Like that's like in 2 days.
Yeah.
So
it's very, yeah. Like it's very frightening. Like what might come. And yeah, I think that, we'll have to see how it plays out. But I am pretty frightened for, all the terrible possibilities. So anyway, those are some thoughts on what happened in the Capitol, and we're not even close to having enough information yet. What were the other trains of thought, Joy of Napping?
Well, so if the first one was more about like violent insurrection and its future, the second one was about Trumpism and its future, which and Trump himself, you know, which I think is like it's like diminished but not gone. And diminished in prestige, in that, like, you know, the Goldman Sachses of the world really don't want to, like, might in the past have been willing to, like, host an event at Mar-a-Lago, and I'm guessing that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, I read from Maggie Haberman from the New York Times that, like, when Trump got impeached, I think the same, within 24 hours, the PGA said they wouldn't be hosting a very prestigious tournament at one of his properties, and that really gutted him. Like, he was really, not so much about the impeachment.
I think that happened actually last week, the PGA announcement. It was before the impeachment.
Yeah. So.
Impeachment 2.
fair enough. Yeah, I mean, my sense of time is getting pretty blurred, but yeah, he was very upset about that. So a lot of organizations are having their PACs, PACs, like reevaluate whether they're going to contribute to Republicans that supported the insurrection. The PGA is pulling support from Trump. Like, all kinds of things are happening right now. What are your thoughts on it overall?
Well, I think a lot of what I have been reflecting on lately is, like, how did I think this was going to end? You know, I knew it wouldn't go well after he lost the election. And I think you and I had talked a lot about, like, oh, we just have to brace ourselves for Lord knows what. You know, he's going to start a war to distract us. He's going to. But, like, by all accounts, it's actually gone worse than I possibly could have envisioned. By which I mean, he has been more self-destructive mm-hmm. than I thought he was capable of. Because this is a person who's pretty good at looking out for number one. He has, like, no strategy, but he has enormous instincts for self-promotion. And so it is really shocking to me that he didn't understand that, like... So here's an example. Maybe, like, 2 months ago, there was a belief that... within the Republican Party, that there were voting irregularities that they thought they could challenge that were not the conspiracy theory type. And he decided not to go the suggested path. And instead, he went the sort of Linwood, Sydney, what's-her-face, Jenna Ellis. Like, basically, the things that were most...
outrageous, right?
Right. Yeah. And
like there was a sort of relatively conservative small c, like, legal path he could have trod
that was probably more justifiable. I mean, it's interesting. I actually still haven't really seen those claims, like, brought to light, and I do wonder if there's any evidence even behind those, but that they weren't going to be enough to, like, swing the election.
Right.
And so it...
But he could have maybe saved a little face, you know?
Right.
He could have, like, been like, oh, yeah, I had some like, justification for acting out like this. And
but he's always going to want to pull the inside straight, you know? He's always going to just go, like, swing for it hard. And if apparently, you know, he listens to the people who he either heard from the most recently or, you know, who tell him what he wants to hear. And so this is who the path he chose. And I think there's enormous, like, frustration from the relatively... anchored part of his crew, which is, I mean, that's really saying something, because these are not reasonable people with the best interest of the country at heart. But, you know, I think I don't think he got the reputational risk of the Four Seasons total landscaping version of this, you know, that a man who's trying to run a set of luxury resorts around the world and to be associated with never losing and, like, sleeping with, you know, pageant winners and, you know, like, a certain kind of very gauche version of being nouveau riche, but, you know, the flamboyant kind of lifestyle that comes with that, like, that would somehow get tarnished in all of this. So it's interesting to me that, like, he's in businesses that have been really battered by the pandemic, like commercial real estate and luxury hospitality. He, as has been reported, is likely facing pretty large, like, debt payments that either need to be, like, refinanced or things will have to be sold off to meet the obligations. Most of his golf courses are losing money. Most golf courses in general are losing money. It's, like, a really bad business to be in. So it really... felt like he needed to bank on his celebrity to try to make it in this very headwinds kind of set of industries he's in. And he could have probably easily sailed off into the sunset.
If he had conceded this job he didn't even want to do, he had no, like, agenda of any kind that was discernible. He could have just conceded and ridden off into the sunset, like, you've been still highly respected by millions of people, you know?
He could have even still complained a fair bit on the way out about how poorly he was treated, and
yes.
I think that would not have damaged him one scintilla. And so it's interesting to me that, you know, all of us are like frogs in boiling water in this country in terms of, like, the racism and the amount of horrible, you know, alarming, anxious, anxiety-producing behavior that he's put us through. But I think he also has been like a frog in boiling water. Like, I think he did not know because he lacks the capacity to know. when he was really in danger. And I think he is, I'm not empathizing with him, but I think he is a very tragic, sad, and like broken person. And of course, I'm extremely sorry that we're all tied to him.
Yeah. Well, I think that's true. But, you know, in his defense, quote unquote, right, he has faced virtually zero consequences for any of the negative things he's ever done. And that includes, you know, any time in the last 4 years. I mean, you know, as of right now, like over 300,000 people, I think we're basically absorbing a 9/11's worth of deaths per day, more than a 9/11's worth of deaths per day from the pandemic. And there's this line that Trump said 4 years ago that was extremely prescient. He said, "I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and these people would still vote for me." And that has proven to be true. And so if, you know, I think I'm a better person than Trump, but I can understand the mindset of somebody who, like, faces absolutely no consequences, acting purely on their id, and decides to just ride that strategy all the way to its logical conclusion. And I think we're seeing that also with the impeachment. I don't want to get ahead. I think that was your final train.
But like, my third piece was about the Biden administration.
So, oh yeah, that's right. But like with the impeachment, I think over 100 Republican congressmen still voted or still kind of like supported objections to the certifying of the votes. And only 10 Republicans, or like around there, right? Only 10 Republicans 10. Voted in the House, voted in favor of impeachment.
But two from Washington State out of our three. So thank you.
And so these, like, what the night the votes were certified, right? People had breached the Capitol building. There was a gallows outside. They had specifically stated they wanted to kill Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi and probably do damage. Like, if they'd found people, Lord knows what kind of damage they would have done, what assaults would have occurred, what deaths would have occurred. And after all that, they cleared the building and the Republicans were still like, "I still object." And it's like, there's no bottom for these people. You know, like, there's nothing that can be, like, even when their lives are in danger, they will hold the line.
So by these people, you mean GOP House members? That's who you're talking
correct
about.
In that instance, yeah. And also some senators. I think it was like six, right?
You mean the ones that like objected to the certification,
yeah,
of the vote?
The seditious six, as they've been called online. So
yeah, I mean,
so I think the basic my point being, like, throughout his entire term, up until the last, when their own lives were in danger, these supporters have shown Donald Trump complete deference to everything he's been doing. So afraid are they of losing their own jobs. And so I understand.
And to some extent, you know, their lives, which, you know, that part is very hard for me to stomach. But,
well, you're bringing up the fact that today, or I think yesterday, I apologize if I'm getting the dates wrong, but like a Democratic congressperson said that several Republican colleagues of his had wanted to vote for impeachment, but they feared for their lives. And several people I know referred to this as terrorism, right? Like, one person I listened to on podcast called it tyranny. The idea that, like,
oh yeah, how would we cover this if this were in Afghanistan? Yeah, several people wanted to vote for reforms, but they feared the Taliban would kill them and their families, so they didn't.
It's hard. I feel like the game has already been lost, you know, like at that point, that we are having people saying, like, "I fear for my life," because the media, because the president of the United States, because the people who support him have ginned up his supporters to such an extent that they will literally kill me and my family if I vote my conscience. What's the point of having them in office at this point? What's the point of even having an office at all, you know, like, or a representative democracy? Anyway, I'm digressing a little bit from what you said, but, you know, this is kind of a...
Well, I think it actually does tie into this topic of Trump and Trumpism. So I think Trump is diminished, but still around, is my guess, in the future. But then Trumpism, like, what is Trumpism? It's like some mix of white resentment and status threat. You know, I guess it has some policy implications, but it's real hard to stitch together like a coherent narrative out of anti-abortion policies and gun rights and low taxes. And, you know, of course, that is like the Republican coalition. And then what I think is really like some defining characteristics of Trumpism is starkness in how you view your people who disagree with you as enemies. And a tendency toward conspiracy and like convoluted explanations that are like extraordinarily defensive, right? Like they're all too, and I find it so interesting that it's like a lot of the narratives I've heard afterwards are, well, we're not fascists. We're preventing Joe Biden from taking office because he's a fascist. You know, we're not the terrorists. Black Lives Matter is the terrorists. We're not, you know, like there's a way of like reframing everything to be about somebody else or some sort of boogeyman that I think is fascinating. I mean, it's certainly a personal characteristic of his, but feels like characteristic to the movement too. So Frank Luntz, who is the GOP pollster, pretty famous dude, said after January 6th that he convened a focus group of Republican voters, all of whom had supported Trump, and they fell into like three camps. One camp was, I think Biden won and Trump should therefore move on. A second camp was, I think Trump actually won and was cheated, but I think he should move on. And honestly, if I'm being really open, I think I fell a little bit into that camp myself in 2016, which is like, I couldn't quite really believe that Hillary Clinton had really lost because it was so close in those few swing states and she had won the popular vote. So I really thought probably there was like some sort of like Russian misinformation campaign that directed just enough people in just these few places to swing the election.
Yeah, but I think you're saying like people in that category are still within like a standard deviation of like the average person.
Well, right? Like I could see how somebody could get there.
Right.
And my reaction to that was like, you know, we really should open a bunch of investigations into like what happened here. But I also get that practically speaking, like might makes right. And we basically did lose effectively. And I'm just going to have to move on. Now, I will say on that point, I have since changed my opinion because seeing that he won, Trump won 74 point whatever million votes, increasing his vote totals from 2016 to 2020 after all that he has shown us about who he is, made me believe the 71 million was real in the first place.
Correct.
From 2016.
It really makes it feel like 2016 was not a fluke. That was what I originally thought. It was like, oh, people were like taking a chance on Trump. You know, they didn't know if he would be good or not. Maybe they just said like, hey, why not? Why not? Give it a shot. But what we saw in this year's election or 2020's election was that they were for it. They knew who
he was. I mean,
maybe
some people took a chance on him, but not enough. You know, whatever. Right. I think he probably did win it fair and square. And anyway, my point is, like, I was in that middle camp or something like it of, like, you know, I don't think this was 100% fair, but, like, whatever. We all have to move on.
Yeah.
Even when the stakes are high, even when it's very upsetting.
Yeah.
And then the final camp is, like, Trump didn't lose the election and Trump should fight. And what Frank Luntz pointed out was that it was normally what you would see among Trump voters is this sort of camaraderie of like, oh, like I know my neighbor yells at me for being a Trump voter. Like it sucks, you know, like it's us against them. You know, like there's a, even if they differ on certain things, but that these three groups of people were like passionately fighting with each other. So I do think there is some schism ahead for the Republican Party itself. And you see it in the reaction to the impeachment vote. And out of that group that thinks that Trump should still keep fighting, I actually think there are, if I think of that as the core of Trumpism, I think there's like some sort of white supremacy, white resentment group and somewhat overlapping. There's like a QAnon-based group. And I said to you earlier today, I think the QAnon group might actually be the easier one to get back into some sort of civil society, where I probably will still disagree with them about everything. But there's some, you know, my sense is that they are really suffering.
Well, because they've believed all these, the thing about the QAnon groups that I think will help bring them back is their beliefs are incredibly intense and specific.
Right. And there's like a prophecy,
A prophecy. So it's like, if this thing does not come true, it kind of shatters.
For one, some of them.
One part of the world. And it, the more things don't come true or don't play out the way they're supposed to, like eventually it becomes harder and harder to believe. Whereas if you just kind of generally have feelings in favor of white supremacy, you know, there's not that much you can do to take away from that.
You've got decades and decades of that movement. And I think with the QAnon stuff, of course, it can always morph into some other conspiracy. But I think for many people, if January 20th comes and Joe Biden is inaugurated, or somebody basically who's not Donald Trump, it's going to, I do think it'll be a glass shattering moment for many people. So I will say, I don't know anyone personally, I don't think, who's a QAnon believer, I don't think. But if I did, I've been reading a little bit about it, and apparently now is the time to be very warm and kind and vague to those people, because if the glass does shatter, they're going to want to have somewhere to turn to. And let's try to welcome back as many of them as we can our functioning society.
That's one thing that's like difficult for me, you know, which is that like, one of the piece of advice people give, if you have people like friends in your life who believe in conspiracy theories, is do not cut them out of your life. Because if you cut them out of your life, that's like one other pathway they have to get back to like normal life that is gone from them. So I agree. Don't cut them out from your life, despite all the horrible things that have happened. And also, as you said, Joy, be very nice, warm, and vague. Don't be specific about things you believe and so on and so forth. The stuff that you're discussing was kind of the topic of an article that came out today entitled "Post Capitol Hill Riot Polls Reveal Big Problem for GOP." This is in New York Magazine. Quote, "One week after inciting a terrorist attack against Congress while attempting to end constitutional government in the U.S., Donald Trump's approval rating is approaching an all-time low. Put differently, even after the president's attempt to nullify a Democratic election got five people killed, including a police officer, about 40% of Americans believe he's doing a good job, according to 538's polling average. This is bad news for American democracy, but it's also an inauspicious number for the leading threat to that democracy, the modern Republican Party." This article then goes on to say that in a political morning consult poll taken after the Capitol Hill riot, 75% of Republican voters said they approved of the job Trump is doing, down from 83% in December. And a Reuters Ipsos survey taken during the same period put Trump's support at 70%, an all-time low, and 18 points beneath the peak he'd reached in August. So things are looking bad for him among the Republican base even, right? I mean, they're still pretty good overall, but like these are some all-time lows. This was the glass-shattering moment for a lot of Republicans, what happened at the Capitol last week, right?
So I think, though...
not enough of them, though, but...
The challenge, of course, is that, like, the districts are gerrymandered for the House in such a way that it basically promotes extremism, to some extent, on both sides. So, like, that... if people aren't familiar with this, basically, you can draw the boundaries for a House district however you feel like it. And they're very, very weird looking as a result if you look at them on a map. They're often drawn to basically have a foregone conclusion that the GOP or the Democrat will win, like based on whoever is controlling the map. So the district has just enough Democratic voters to like always turn out to be a Democratic district, or the vice versa for if the Republicans are in charge. And I will say, I don't want to be both sides-ish about this. I think the Republican gerrymandering is perceived to be worse. So more extreme. Therefore, to get elected to Congress, all you have to do is win your primary. You don't really need to face a real challenger from another party in November. You just have to win your primary a few months earlier. And in the primary, it's not a race to the middle. It's a race to the extreme.
Yeah.
And so this is how we end up with Marjorie Taylor Greene. Is that her name?
I'm Marjorie. Not
something Green from Georgia, or Lauren Boebert from Colorado, is that they just, you know, the primary voters tend to be the party's most hardcore and ardent, and the most ardent tend to be right now Trump supporters. So out of your 70% that still support him versus the 30 that don't, you would think the 70% are more motivated to continue to show up. And so it's going to still have a lasting, I think, influence on the party that's in some ways like outsized. And it's really interesting to see where QAnon in particular, like, because there are a couple, the two people I named are, you know, believe in QAnon, like where that goes without like its effective deity at the center of it.
Yeah. Agreed. It'll be interesting to see. I have a bunch more like random scattered thoughts about this whole, before we move on to like Biden stuff, I have a bunch more random scattered thoughts about Trump and the impeachment and everything like that. One of the things is that like the descriptions and scenes that have emerged of like what happened that day on the Capitol are truly horrifying. And as you said, like a Capitol police officer was killed. And it's just the thing that is challenging for me to wrap my head around is just like the just complete inconsistency of people who believe in Trumpism. Like there's no core animating ideology between like other than like the lust for power and the subjugation of like non-white people. And the idea of like Blue Lives Matter, you know, this crowd shouting USA, you know, many of whom are like Blue Lives Matter people, pulling a police officer out and like murdering him, you know, it just, I guess murder is, I don't know if that's technically the right word because, you know,
beating him until he died.
Yeah. Beating him until he died. You know, like it's just, it's horrifying. And I was saying like this conflict between like being pro-life and like not giving a crap whether or not anyone gets the virus or, you know, deciding they don't want to wear a mask because why would you, why would I abridge my personal freedom? It just, it earns so much of my disdain because like it, at least if you had like consistent principles, I could at least understand where you're coming from and what the, and like respect that. But like,
I think that the left has its own share of like strange inconsistencies. But what I do think is like the unifying principle is sort of an anti-principle, which is like they want maximum freedom and they want not socialism. And socialism for them is like this boogeyman that I think is not an actual threat, like, but it is a fear, like a deep, visceral, primal fear for them for which they are willing to die.
Yeah. So that's fair enough. That, I mean, you've articulated in a way that that's at least consistent, but is no less upsetting, right?
Oh yeah. I think it's quite upsetting, but I think the rationale would be something along the lines of, I have to do this because my cause is just, it's the thing I will do that will save my family. You know, it's framed in ways that are not nihilistic, right?
Yeah.
I need to preserve what made this country great. Let's just put that in quotes because everyone's definition of that is different, as well as I don't know exactly if this country has been great yet. I have terrible fear about what, like, I think this is our last stand. This is our last moment before we get swept away into tides of multiculturalism, socialism, you know, eroding status for people like me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, if someone dies in the process, that sucks, but they were a martyr in a way to the cause. Like they're trying to make a martyr out of Ashley Babbitt,
yeah,
the Air Force veteran who was shot.
Yeah, I mean, that all makes sense. And I think, like, as I'm reflecting on the impeachment and the events of the last week, the other thing that comes to mind is, you know, we talked about this in this Patreon recording we did about how, like, so many people, including President-elect Biden, have been saying, you know, this is not who we are, this is not who America is. A lot of calls for unity from the Republican Party, a lot of calls for like, hey, this is not the thing that's going to bring the country together. And I think there's like a multi-pronged self-interest in that. Number one is they know if they go against Trump, it'll be bad for them. Number two is we are hearing rumors that many of these Republican Congress people have been like potentially involved in giving insurrectionist tour of the Capitol or supporting them in some
way. I want to be really careful because that's like a super, super hardcore charge. I think it's like 3 to 5. So that's like more than zero, but I just don't want it to sound like dozens
yeah,
or hundreds.
Sure. No, that's
like,
that's a fair point. That's a fair point. But basically we don't know whether or not any of them were complicit in the events that happened, and we probably won't know for a while. But I guess the point being that like the calls for unity and like rising above this are, I find, like, I'm quite skeptical of them. I think, you know, the way you get unity is, first of all, learning exactly what happened. Secondly, holding accountable those who were responsible. And like, that is when the healing can begin. You know, there's this idea of like, I've heard some evangelical Christians say like, oh, forgiveness is the way. Don't you understand? And it's like, yes, well, you're forgetting the first step, which is that the sinner needs to repent. And a lot of people, a lot of Republicans, I think, are forgetting that first step these days.
Well, I actually think it's just incredibly cynical. I don't take it seriously at all, to be honest. So
Fair enough.
You know, if I were in the extremely losing party, I had just lost both, I'd lost the Senate in a state where I should have held both seats in theory. And my, you know, president has decided to go on a rampage and literally have his supporters attack the Capitol over a procedural matter, and while doing so had threatened the vice president as like a totally spineless traitor, basically, in a tweet. I guess I could say unity because it'd be about all I have, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that vote's going to go against you. It's just a matter of by how much. Even, you know, McCarthy, the minority leader, was like, it was very bad and it was definitely his fault and I support censure instead. You know, like, it's not like anyone's like, oh, this was cool. So anyway, I literally just don't engage because I find, I've said this before, but Martin Luther King in his letter from a Birmingham jail talks about how there is a quote unquote white moderate. And I would argue that there's a white moderate in all of us, myself included. I'm not white, you know, but like this desire, to kind of not ruffle feathers,
right?
Forgive, get along,
forgive, forget, move on,
right? And it's very American to just want to move on, move on, and it's why we're so forward-looking and optimistic, frankly. But it also means we like just truly don't reckon with like the sins of our present or our past, and are therefore, you know, doomed to repeat those mistakes if we don't learn from them. And you know, he talks about how the white moderate has a preference for a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, versus a positive peace, which is the presence of justice. And if I believe that America has any chance at justice, I think we've had an enormous amount in the last 40 years of the negative peace, which is the absence of tension.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have not had the positive presence
and,
of justice.
And to be fair, like, some of us have experienced that negative peace and others, you know, have more acutely felt the injustice.
Sure,
right?
Yeah, and it's been able, you know, we can always sort of shove it aside and move it to a different place and not look too closely at it. But it has become so intolerable that more of us are recognizing, like, holy shit, like, that's not justice if this is what I'm seeing with cell phone cameras, you know, recording these different interactions or, you know, particularly if the people who are charged with protecting us are themselves creating injustice, and there seems to be no mechanism by which to hold them accountable.
Yeah.
Not even to hold them accountable, but to like stop it from happening again. You know, I think there are plenty of people that would settle for that. And like, that's not in and of itself justice. That would just be, you know, it would be a huge improvement.
It would be prudent actions.
So anyway, you know, MLK writes this, it's like 1961, I think, or 60, but it's been 60 years, give or take. And nothing's changed about that quote unquote call for unity. Like, I knew it was coming and I literally just ignore it because like, this is not a voice I need to take seriously. It's just a predictable reaction in the same way that if I hit your kneecap you know, most people who have a working reflex will, you know, the ankle will pop out, you know? It just is what it is. It's not an actual signal of anything.
One final note before we move on to this final topic, and that is Adam Serwer wrote this great piece for The Atlantic about how this sequence of events, the Trump administration is a test of multiracial democracy. And in his formulation, multiracial democracy, that is the ability for, you know, all races or people non-white to participate in democracy, has really only truly been in existence for around 50 years since the Voting Rights Act was passed. And he writes here in the article, quote, demanding that a candidate who lost the Electoral College and received 7 million fewer votes than his opponent be allowed to remain president may seem a strange turn for a party that has spent the Trump years presenting itself as the vanguard of the people, but it represents an old worldview in American politics, one that dates back to the founding. There is an element of historical truth to this worldview. America did not have universal suffrage at its founding. The Constitution accepted the existence of slavery and imagined democracy as a responsibility of property-owning white men. But the founders also created a society where the blessings of liberty they imagined for themselves could be extended to others, the promissory note of which Martin Luther King Jr. spoke. Although the story of American democracy is often told as an unsteady but certain march towards a more perfect union, there have always been people who recount that story as a tragedy, one in which the founders' vision of limited government and individual freedom is effaced by the inclusion of those who were never meant to share it. If democracy must be set aside to defend that liberty, then so be it, end quote. So I think he really gets at what, why people are, many people are angry on both sides, right? Like on one side, there's like people who have a vision of this democracy that doesn't include non-white people, right? Or that only includes white people.
Well, what they want is the republic. And if it's not a democracy anymore as a cost, then so
yes,
be it.
Then so be it.
And I mean, I think that's actually a more accurate reading of where we've been. Like, to the point here is it really hasn't been all that democratic of a democracy up until now.
Yeah.
And the consequences of having a true democracy are in some ways terrifying. For people. And, you know, Isabel Wilkerson has written in her book Cast about, you know, if people were had to choose between whiteness and democracy, you know, her point of view is they have consistently chosen whiteness up until now.
Yeah. So I think the idea that, like, this is not who America is, we're better than this, we're not, you know, like, for most of America's history, we have not been better than this. And don't let people, even people like President-elect Joe Biden, who I think I'm looking forward to his administration very much. Don't let them tell you that. Don't forget, don't deny our history, I think, is what my takeaway is from all the events and the rhetoric we've heard this last couple weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a way to call on our better angels and just slightly tweak it and say, you know, this is not who America wants to be.
Or
this is not
be,
who America ought to be.
Or
it's
aspires
not, yes,
to be.
Exactly.
You know, like all these other things.
This is not the American dream that we all had
right,
in mind. So
right. just take it. Just take the descriptive, declarative language down just a little bit. Well, not declarative, just descriptive. Okay. Final topic. Biden administration, you're looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, assuming it comes, that's where I am at this point. Mm. I assume he's in a basement. I assume he's not being coughed on by agents of the armed insurrection or the unarmed insurrection who happen to have COVID and like are infecting him. You know, like who knows? Assuming in 6 days he does take office at noon Eastern, which is 9 a.m. Pacific. It's already going to be a really tough transition because of the slowness in accepting the results in the first place. But moreover, there have been up until even now, like blockages in transition in some departments. A whole bunch of secretaries have stepped down. So there's like no one to transition from even, which maybe isn't the biggest loss. But like the acting DHS head, the Elaine Chao, and then acting DHS head Chad Wolf, Elaine Chao, Labor, and Betsy DeVos for Education. And they have to confirm all of his cabinet picks, which is not the easiest or fastest process. I do think that it's just alarming to me, like, how fast we need to move on those, because it's not like there's someone currently there running things in a smooth way. So the days that we lose actually do matter. if I were a foreign enemy of the United States, I would be like, this is my time to shine. Like, no one's there. Everyone's very distracted. And he is very limited in his political power to get anything done. But presuming that all of those, you know, minefields actually get navigated and we make it through, it's already been heartening to hear who the picks are for the different, you know, are they always my choices? No. Are they better than every single person that's there now? Yes, absolutely. And in many cases, I'm happy with the choices. I'm, of course, happy with the diversity of lived experiences. Jamie Harrison also has been picked to run the DNC, which, I mean, is just such a meteoric rise for him and exciting. And on the policy front, obviously, the most important two things are the pandemic and the economy. And Biden is already giving policy addresses. He gave one today. It had whole sentences and complete thoughts and a framework that made sense. And I don't know if this thing will pass or not, but it's a great starting point. And it includes the $15 minimum wage. And, you know, it feels so validating for somebody to just say some sort of policy proposal that makes any kind of sense given the enormity of the problem we are facing. So whether you think it should be a $2,000 check or an $1,800 check or whether it should have more means testing or whatever, like, we can all debate about that. But there's no part of this which is like, I'm just going to magically hope for it to go away. I'll just wait for it to die of its own accord. And like, it's, or I'm just doing it for however it tests with polling. Like, it's really exciting to have an actual leader coming in.
Yeah, I completely agree. I dare not hope. I mean, you know, by this point, we're like an hour into this episode, and so most people won't have listened this far. But I have some friends, some colleagues, who were very like in the, you know, like, Biden sucks, like, Bernie or bust. And I'm just like, dude, the only way we can get even close. Like, some people think your vote is like a sacred thing. You only vote for people who are like 100% aligned with your views, right? I do not believe that. I believe you should vote to accomplish the things that you want to have happen, right? And it's like a different point of view. It's a completely different worldview. And I think Biden, he's not going to be perfect. He's going to do a bunch of things wrong. He's not going to be as left as a lot of people want. But at least you have a chance of getting the thing you want done to have it happened under Biden. And I am encouraged by the fact that, like, he's already actually, like, started listening. Like, there's a bunch of things he's already done that, have been probably further left than he would have wanted, but he's been pulled because, I think
he listens.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. I think he listens. He's not perfect. He's not like the greatest, but it's like, compared to what we've had the last four years, I think it's going to be a lot better.
Like, I think it'll get better from a policy perspective and whatever, because we have both, you know, the houses of Congress plus him. And my own lived experience of this extreme hellscape of the last like 10, 11 months or whatever it's been since COVID arrived, which, you know, just took an already very bad situation, you know, into the deep recesses of the sewer system. I feel more like a person when I hear him talk, because he sees that obvious problems are problems and he is willing to tell me the truth about it.
It's very validating, right? As opposed to having someone who tells you, somebody who has an enormous power telling you it's not a problem, right?
Not only it's not a problem, but something that's the opposite of that, you know? So, like, he has to convince you, like, to disbelieve your own eyes and ears, right, and then sell you on a different story. And it's just, like, exhausting, the carrying cost of that. You know what I would like? I would like to grieve the 345,000 people that have died so far of COVID. Like, I would like to have a national day of mourning where we, like, actually take time aside. Maybe everyone could take the day off of work and we could all just sit and think about what we have fucking lost. I actually think that would be incredibly healthy for us. And I'm not saying that
I need him to do that. But like, that's the kind of thing where I start to believe we might have space for a less dysfunctional relationship with the truth.
Yeah. I think for me, as I'm pondering this, right, there is a lot of like sadness at the tragedy of what this country has gone through. But I actually, in my mind, have not real much space for sadness because it's been replaced by anger, you know, anger at the fact that certainly Trump was a huge part of it, but it's more the people that enabled it to happen. The people around him, the people who supported him, people like Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley. Like, I have a lot of anger at like that they continue to prop this guy up who drove this country into a ditch, right? A ravine. And that if we're lucky, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are going to like help us find our way out of this thing. So that's like, yes, it's incredibly tragic that all this, like, you know, like you said, hundreds of thousands of people have died, and like, I want to feel sad, but instead I'm just really pissed about it. Maria Bustillos, one of my favorite writers, wrote this piece over at Popula.com called The Incalculable. It's really a brilliant piece. I'd recommend you read it. I'll link to this and all the other things in the show notes. It's about her mom who passed away in the last year. And she, you know, she didn't necessarily die of COVID, but like she had health, like Maria Bustillos like speculates she might have had COVID like a year ago, but either way, once COVID started, she couldn't get seen by the hospital or by her doctor for health reasons because of COVID. And she writes here, quote, "People are dying of COVID who never had it. And also I've been reckoning up everything else that was lost through the stupidity and venality of Republicans this dark year. All the time we didn't get to be together, if you were to add it up, beautiful things that couldn't be made because of the dearth of happiness, peace, or calm, songs written, slow dances in middle school auditoriums and slumber parties and torrid affairs, unwelcome birthday surprises, evenings at a bar with a big gang of friends, a coffee date with someone you haven't seen for years. All these millions and millions, a year of life when you are very old, and every moment spent with the grandchildren who adore you is a life-giving nectar. My mom died alone. The few who could make it on short notice, watching her nearly last breaths with me over the computer, all of us hooked up to some machines." And then she concludes, "It is possible to make a world where everyone's time and quality of life have value, and everyone could be as loved as my mom was and will always be." And that's kind of what I think about when, you know, that's what comes to mind when you're talking about what is coming next for us. There is a possible world where people's lives and their experiences, their individuality, their health, their futures are valued. And I hope we can make it so.
Well, we know an increasing number of people that have gotten the vaccine. Slowly increasing. And I do, despite myself, have optimism for 2021, maybe not January or even February.
Or March.
Or April.
Maybe let's start in the fall, you know?
Yeah. You know, but
Oscar season.
I have switched to this mindset instead of feeling like I'm just trying to get through from day to day. Like, I'm trying to exit this thing in 6 months or be prepared. You know, like, who knows when we'll really exit.
This pandemic.
Yeah, but I'm trying to exit a life of quarantine and shutdown. And I know it won't be like a light switch flipping back on, but I've gained some COVID weight. COVID plus anxiety plus whatever. And our bubble neighbor is an amazing cook. So, you know, I'll throw that in there too. I've also probably not like had as much energy to focus on my health. And that's a huge, you know, important issue for me, you know, with my own medical history. And I think none of us are sleeping well. And, you know, like, I don't think this has been good for anybody's wellness. So I'm trying to take the remainder of the time from here to whenever we exit, as soon as Biden really gets inaugurated, to
like try to take a little bit of my focus away from like reacting in frozen horror every day to the news, to like nourishing myself, nourishing those around me, and doing things that are more positive instead of like defensive against, you know, these terrible forces at work in the world. It's not to say I don't think those forces will still exist, but I also think as this goes on, the need for self-care actually increases. And so, as always, I hope, you know, people are able to be kind to themselves right now. And I hope that as things get better, there's more capacity for that.
So say we all. We hope you're staying safe and healthy out there, taking care of yourselves. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Culturally Relevant. You can find more episodes at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. Follow this podcast on Twitter, CrevShow, CrevShow. This podcast is brought to you by Simplecast. Check them out for a great podcast management and analytics solution, simplecast.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, do us a favor, leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. It really makes a big difference. That's going to do it for us today. Thanks for chatting with me, Joy.
It's always a pleasure.